We are joined live here in the KODX studios by none other than Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik. Good afternoon.
And welcome back, Jav.
Yeah, Jav. Thank you. We are elated to have you back.
At last.
Yeah.
Yeah, I spent 5 weeks in the hospital, which was not a lot of fun. I'd rather be here, so I'm here now.
Good.
All right, and hopefully we can keep you here.
That's the goal. I was just wondering why you locked that door.
Hopefully you've been watching the news and online.
There's not a whole lot else to do in the hospital.
All right. So starting out with local, last week we were talking about these new emphasis sweeps.
The new emphasis patrols, yeah.
Patrols.
This week in City Council member Lorena Gonzalez's Public Safety Committee on Wednesday, the council heard from representatives of the Seattle Police Department, the mayor's office, Seattle Public Utilities, and several other city departments about what the new emphasis patrols are going to be. Last week, the Seattle Police Department and Mayor Durkin announced that during the month of May, the Seattle Police would be conducting emphasis patrols of 7 neighborhoods to proactively prevent crime and clean the streets ahead of the summer tourist season. That's not how they phrased it, but that's essentially what they said.
In other words, get the homeless out of sight.
Yeah. The 7 neighborhoods chosen by the Seattle Police Department and the mayor are downtown, especially along 3rd Avenue between Pike and Pine, a one-block area, Pioneer Square, Soto, Georgetown, South Park, Fremont, and South Ballard. Now, this led to 2 responses on the city council. First, Lorena Gonzalez sent a letter to the mayor and the Seattle Police Department to asking them to explain how the 7 neighborhoods were chosen, what crimes the Seattle Police Department would target, and whether the city was using a racial equity analysis in designing the patrols instead of just sweeping people of color into jail for the summer.
The answer to that is no.
Yeah. And she wanted to know if they were providing scarce police resources for relatively safe North Seattle neighborhoods while ignoring less wealthy neighborhoods like the Central District or Rainier Valley, for example. Second, the new council member, Abel Pacheco, pointed out multiple times that the University District has a higher crime rate than some of the neighborhoods on the list, like Fremont and Ballard, for example. And he asked, why wasn't it chosen for the emphasis patrols? Now, the Seattle Police Department representative struggled to explain how the city chose those 7 neighborhoods, saying that crime statistics were just one piece of data used to make the decision. The term community input and perception of crime came up often during that meeting, leading to questions again of whether the mayor and the Seattle Police Department are responding to a fear of crime expressed by mostly middle and upper middle class white residents instead of a real crime surge. Many of the new residents in Seattle, of course, have moved here from other towns and rural areas in Washington state that are mostly white, like Spokane, Olympia, Tumwater, and rural areas of eastern and western Washington. We've also received a sizable influx of people from Midwestern states like Illinois, Ohio, Missouri, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, Utah, and Texas. And southern states like Florida and Georgia make up a healthy chunk of the more than 16,000 people who moved to Seattle last year and are moving to Seattle every year. So not all of our new residents are coming from California and Oregon, and many of them have never lived in a big city before or are uncomfortable seeing homeless people or interacting with people of color. Now, during the Public Safety Committee meeting, the city representatives described the emphasis patrols as being bicycle cops who would patrol and prevent street crime from occurring, while other city departments make repairs, fixing street lights, cleaning graffiti, filling potholes, etc. But it's not clear that those neighborhoods are seeing higher levels of street crime or whether taking a broken windows approach to street crime will help house the 11,000 homeless people on our streets or help heroin addicts kick their drug habit. Now, most of the complaints of rising crime in Seattle seem to be complaints about finding heroin needles in public places, seeing homeless people camping on the street, especially homeless people with addictions or mental illnesses, and complaints from businesses about shoplifters, like addicts stealing stuff to sell. If the mayor is serious about addressing these complaints, she would be looking for ways to fund more drug treatment and harm reduction programs that actually work. funds. She would be looking for funds to build more affordable housing, and she'd be pushing the state legislature to fully fund mental health services in the state of Washington, which the state legislature did not do this year, even though the Democrats had made the promise and Governor Inslee had made the promise that that would happen. And that's not what we're hearing from Durkin. Instead, we get this street sweep program that puts money into police overtime pay. That's her response to these complaints from folks who are afraid of crime, not necessarily because there's a real crime surge in Seattle.
Yeah, another indicator that Mayor Durkin is pretty intent on a spring cleaning of Seattle streets of people who look icky or something. Mm-hmm. Was the Navigation Team's weekly report this past week that the team removed 39 encampments in the last month. Of those, 34 were deemed to be hazardous. That's all but five were deemed to be hazardous or an obstruction, and they're therefore exempt from the requirements that ordinarily apply to encampment removals.
Like 72-hour notice.
Like 72-hour notice, and also that the campers be offered shelter or housing, which simply doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Conveniently, they didn't have to do that. All they could just to get them to move along and find some other place to camp out of tourist eyesight.
Yeah, and the Navigation Team has a lot of discretion in determining when a homeless encampment is either hazardous or an obstruction, and that includes whether that site has been occupied by homeless people before. If they've swept that encampment in the past, given 72 hours notice because it wasn't an obstruction at that time, if people come back to that encampment, they can then claim that it is an obstruction because it's been habitually used by homeless people, and then they can sweep it without notice.
No matter how far out of the way it is.
Yeah. Supposedly, they're supposed to give 30 minutes notice when they do these hazardous or obstruction sweeps, but they don't always do that either. Is what we're hearing from folks on the street.
Yeah, and people often lose their personal possessions, ID cards, medications, et cetera, that just get thrown into the dumpster by the Navigation.
Yeah, so I think a lot of the shoplifting that's occurring are homeless people needing clothes, needing medications, needing things like combs, soap, that kind of stuff. Just utensils to eat with. That's a lot of what I think is being shoplifted around the city of Seattle and that business owners are complaining about.
All right. sticking with the stats this week, hate crimes apparently are up.
Yeah. If you were to ask, well, gosh, Maria, what crimes are up in the city of Seattle? This week, we got a report on one that is up so much that it just seems astonishing. Hate crimes apparently are up 500% in the city of Seattle. Hate crimes are defined as any crime that is motivated primarily by bias against a person because of their color, gender, religion, ethnic origin, sexual orientation, et cetera, age, disability, homelessness, and
it's a real measure of the changing demographics in Seattle that you were referring to earlier.
Yeah, it is a measure of the changing demographics in Seattle. City Council member Lisa Herbold had commissioned a report from the Seattle Police Department regarding the number of hate crimes in Seattle since 2012. The SPD delivered that report this week, and the SPD has a new reporting system that more accurately counts when a crime is motivated by hate. So some of the increase is related to better tracking. Some is related to the city's efforts to prevent hate crimes, including raising awareness of them throughout the city. But I don't think that seems like it would account for a more than fivefold increase. Of course, there's that, like Job said, there's that influx of new white folks, mostly men, who work in high-paying tech jobs, many of whom are not used to interacting with women, people of color, gay people, older people, people with disabilities, and homeless people. There's also the new climate of white
and
nationalism.
Immigrants. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, President Trump.
Yes, thank you, President Trump. And he has popularized expressing his bigotry, and that has set an example for a lot of these folks. Unfortunately, the mayor has not proposed any new initiative to address the surge in hate crimes, like she has proposed these new sweeps to address an non-existent surge in street crime. And these hate crimes often occur in public places like on the street. Councilmember Herbold, however, has said that she'll be introducing a new bill to the council in the coming week or two that will make it easier to prosecute hate crimes. Of the many hate crimes that are reported every year, very, very few are actually prosecuted.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. This week, ICE shifted its flights from Seattle to...
Yeah. Immigration and Customs Enforcement shifted its deportation flights from Boeing Field over to Yakima now that ICE can't fly immigrants in and out of the King County Airport, otherwise known as Boeing Field. They've shifted their deportation flights to the Yakima Air Terminal at McAllister Field in eastern Washington. Detainees are being bused from the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma over the Cascade Mountains to Yakima and put on flights to El Paso, Texas for processing. ICE flew 34,000 immigrants through the King County Airport from 2010 through 2018, according to a report by the University of Washington's Center for Human Rights. Some of those deportation flights and were deportation flights, and some were to bring immigrants in to be imprisoned in the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma while they await their court hearings, which can take months or years.
Yeah, and the conditions at the Northwest Detention Center are notoriously bad.
Yeah, they are. The contractor at McAllister Field that is servicing the flights is Swift Air, which is based in Phoenix, Arizona, and it advertises itself as a luxury private airline that flies VIPs, corporate executives, presidential candidates, and sports teams. They also fly charter flights to the Caribbean, to places like Cuba and the Dominican Republic. They're considered the largest private airline charter business in the United States. They're not a public company that lists on a stock exchange. They're privately held. In December, Swift Air was purchased by iAero Group, a holding company for other aviation-related companies, but Swift Air still operates as if it were independent. The company has a low rating on Glassdoor.com, which means its employees are not happy, and there are online pilot discussion forums about safety problems and unethical business practices at the company. Also, there are a lot of complaints from customers who've taken Swift Air charter flights to the Caribbean on late departures and arrivals, poor customer service, et cetera.
Sounds like something that we would really recommend a Trump administration contract.
Yeah. Of course, with ICE flights, Swift Air doesn't have to worry about customer complaints.
Or customer satisfaction.
Exactly. They also don't have to worry about staffing those flights with highly motivated employees who want to provide top-notch customer service. And those flights are a guaranteed source of income as long as Donald Trump is in office. Also, that raises the question of the taxpayer cost of all these flights. With the surge of immigration enforcement and the surge of detentions, you have to be asking, okay, moving all these people around has got to cost a pretty penny. We just don't know how much the Trump administration has spent over the last 2 years to do that. We do know that overcrowding in detention centers near the border with Mexico has led the Trump administration to begin not busing or moving people by land between the border and detention centers, but using flights, short-term flights to move immigrants from the border to processing centers and between processing centers in Texas. That's got to be really, really expensive. It's worth noting, too, that May 1st was the deadline for the Trump administration had committed to releasing the remaining funds that Congress had voted to Puerto Rico to help with Puerto Rico's hurricane response. And May 1st came and went, and the Trump administration has yet to release those funds. I just wonder if that's because they're spending them instead on Donald Trump's immigration enforcement.
They can't get the funds to Puerto Rico because it's a really, really big ocean.
Yeah, there's a really big ocean there. On the other hand, they can fly detainees all around the country instead. So I think the Trump administration is really good at spending money where it wants to. It's really bad for accounting, adding up how much money it's spending. Of course, that should be no surprise with the way Donald Trump manages his personal finances. And it's
about that in a minute.
Really, really bad at being accountable for how it's spending its money.
And it has exploded the national
debt. I should say, your taxpayer money.
Yes, and they have exploded the national debt in the last 2 years.
They have indeed.
All right. Moving on, Jay Inslee does a 180 on his support for a couple natural gas projects.
Yeah, Governor Inslee has been busy signing bills passed by the state legislature, including a bill that set the state on a path to zero emissions energy production. This week, he went another step in that direction by withdrawing his previous support for two natural gas projects in the state. The first project is the Kalama Methanol Manufacturing Plant in Kalama, Washington. It would be a petrochemical refinery that would turn natural gas into methanol to ship to China, where that methanol would be used to produce gasoline for automobiles and used in the production of plastics and paint, among other products. It would be the largest methanol production plant in the world, producing up to 3.6 million metric tons of methanol per year.
And we should mention that that contributes mightily to global warming.
It does indeed. The Kalama plant would use, also the Kalama plant would use up to 5 million gallons of water taken from the Columbia River and Kalama aquifers. It would store 72 million gallons of flammable methanol in a region of the world that's prone to earthquakes. The plant would emit more than 1 million tons per year of greenhouse gases. That's just the plant using energy to produce that methanol.
Yeah, and it's about 20 miles upwind from Portland.
Yeah, and it would ship methanol to China, and by shipping that by boat, it would release hundreds of thousands of tons more of greenhouse gases. And again, that's before the methanol is even used. That's also not counting the amount of methanol released into the air in the production of the natural gas that the plant would use. Now, the liquefied natural gas plant in Tacoma, Washington is the other project. That would produce fuel to power commercial ships. Puget Sound Energy, who's building the plant, says that liquefied natural gas is cleaner than the diesel fuel and bunker fuel that ships currently use. But liquefied natural gas is made from fracked natural gas, which involves the release of large amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is 84 to 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere. Proponents of natural gas claim that this doesn't really matter because methane breaks down much more quickly than carbon dioxide. However, if you take that into account, that the fact that it breaks down faster, its greenhouse effect is still 23 times greater than carbon dioxide's effect. This means that natural gas is absolutely not a clean fuel source. That in fact, the more natural gas we produce, the worse global warming is likely to become. Among the groups protesting the liquefied natural gas in Tacoma are the Puyallup tribe, the affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians and other native groups, Citizens for a Healthy Bay, Columbia Riverkeeper, and many other environmental groups, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the Washington State Democratic Central Committee, and many, many district and county Democrat groups. So it's good news that Governor Inslee has finally withdrawn his support for these two projects, even if he's doing it to benefit his presidential campaign. The final environmental impact statement was issued in April for the liquefied natural gas plant in Tacoma, and it didn't take into account methane released in the production of natural gas. Inslee, as governor, can work with the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency and the State Department of Ecology to block the air permit for the plant's construction and or reopen the environmental review of the liquefied natural gas plant in Tacoma. I really hope he does that and really puts actions to his words.
But it's being built as we speak. I mean, yeah, you can go online and see pictures of it.
Yes,
it's enormous.
But it still is waiting on the clean air permit. And by reopening the environmental review, it could bring that construction to a halt.
It could.
It could. It would be great.
And it also could not.
Like I say, it would be great if
Inslee
took some steps to really bring the construction of that plant to a halt.
Yes, and the public might have something to say about it too.
Oh yes, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, that's what I think we're all hoping for. I'm just pointing out that corporations seem to have a healthy vote because you know they are people, my friend.
Yes.
No, they're not people. Corporations are not people.
So, wasn't that a line from
even
Soylent,
if the law
Soylent
says
Green?
They are.
Corporations are people.
No. No, Soylent Green, our people.
All right. So moving on, anything else on that?
No.
Otherwise, we're going to move on to national. And the developments in two fine states.
Oh, yeah. Well, since President Trump has put two strongly anti-abortion justices on the Supreme Court, red states, state legislatures have been competing with each other to see if they can craft legislation that not only violates Roe v. Wade, but would be guaranteed to be challenged all the way to the Supreme Court with the hope that Roe v. Wade would be overturned. Georgia this week became the fourth state to define to ban abortion after 6 weeks from conception. That, of course, is kind of ridiculous since many women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks, let alone able to make a choice about the fate of their fetus. Alabama trumped that, so to speak. This week, the state legislature tried to pass a bill on a voice vote that would have penalized women who get an abortion or who leave the state to get an abortion with up to 99 years in prison.
That's all abortions.
Yes.
No exceptions.
Yes.
And they just delayed the final vote on that. They didn't
I'm getting to that.
Yeah.
The legislature kind of erupted in chaos when a Republican legislature tried to slip in a late amendment that struck down the exception in the original bill for victims of rape. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, a victim of rape wanting an abortion would face the same 99-year prison prospect. It also contained a definition of conception for personhood, which has got all kinds of legal problems attached to it. And so the vote was delayed. They'll be voting, I believe, on Tuesday. And a lot of national attention is being focused on this because it's so extreme and really looks like an outtake from the next season of Handmaid's Tale. And a lot of people haven't missed that corollary.
Yeah, and it really is a mostly male legislature passing a law that would affect women and would pass a law that is absolutely federally unconstitutional. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yep.
But as Jav mentioned, again, one of the aspects was, I mean, at least in these other states that have passed the laws, a woman can still go out of state to get
it. Yeah.
And this would like
but in
throw
this
her
case,
in jail.
Of course.
In this case,
yeah,
she would have to move permanently out of the state.
And women who have to go out of state, I mean, that's an impossible barrier for a lot of poorer women and women of color. And that, of course, is part of the point as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's crazy. All right. Anything else on that? Otherwise, we can move on to the New York Times coverage, probably in other papers as well, about Trump's tax returns.
Yeah,
well, no, they have an investigative team that won a Pulitzer last year.
It's the New York Times, yeah.
For mm-hmm. deconstructing Trump family fraud of their taxes over many years.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a new report coming out this week.
On Tuesday, it was entitled "Decade in the Red, Trump Tax Figures Show Over $1 Billion in Business Losses." Donald Trump campaigned on his record as a successful businessman, right? And a self-made billionaire. It turns out his billion was $1 billion in losses racked up from 1985 through the mid-1990s. And that billion was not even his own money. But money he borrowed from banks to make bad business deals on luxury properties, hotels, apartment buildings, and casinos that lost money continuously for a decade.
Which is why the only place his company could get funding in recent years was a bank, Deutsche Bank, that is notorious for Russian money laundering.
Well, that's his main creditor. Now, the Times took its information from IRS tax transcripts, which Donald Trump has described as inaccurate. But I should point out that these transcripts are the definitive record of a taxpayer's income and deductions for any given year. Once you filed your tax return, the IRS creates a tax transcript. They're used in audits, in loan applications, in legal cases, in tax court, and they're used by many tax preparers to prepare returns when the original documents are not available. So if the IRS receives K-1s, 1099s, W-2s, et cetera, for your income in a year, those are going to be on your tax transcripts, even if you haven't filed a tax return. So they are the definitive record. Now, the only time a tax transcript might not be correct is if you later file an amended return. But I seriously doubt that Donald Trump has filed 10 amended returns for that entire decade, although it's possible. And that could be why he has been under continuous audit all the time, at least all the time since he's declared his candidacy for president
and been in office.
Well,
he claims that he's been under audit.
Yeah. Now, the New York Times compared Trump's losses to an annual sampling of high-income earners provided by the IRS. They found that Donald Trump seems to have lost more money than nearly any other American during that time period, which may, again, explain why his current tax returns seem to be under perpetual audit. The IRS would definitely want to look at every detail when a businessman has that type of track record to make sure that he's not committing tax fraud and not committing financial fraud. Now, I mean, for example, getting loans, and the chances are that he is. Yeah. For example, getting loans from banks, defaulting on those loans again and again and again and again, and then still being able to get more loans, that would indicate maybe he's not telling the truth when he fills out his loan applications, which is financial fraud.
And we heard
bank fraud.
And we heard from Michael Cohen's testimony to Congress that he was, in fact, not just doing tax fraud, but insurance fraud as well by overvaluing and undervaluing properties.
Yeah.
As to his advantage.
Basically. So that you can decrease your insurance payments if you undervalue your property, for example, or you can increase what the insurance company pays you out if you overvalued. Now, the fact that his current returns are under audit, that's if he's not lying about that, makes me really wonder if Trump's been telling the truth about how much he's currently worth and whether his business is making a profit or still racking up losses. It's possible that running for president was a last-ditch effort to save the Trump empire from imploding under massive debt. And this may be the reason why Deutsche Bank was happy to provide his loan documents to Congress until Donald Trump sued to stop them from doing so.
Yeah, and apparently it's a huge trove that they prepared.
Yeah. Now, in 2018, Bloomberg Business estimated that Donald Trump is currently worth about $2.5 billion. This year, Forbes magazine says it's now $3.1 billion. But the total loans Trump has taken just from Deutsche Bank are at least $2 billion over the last two decades and could be higher than that now with accumulated interest. He also reportedly owes money to the Bank of China and up to 150 other creditors, including Wells Fargo, J.P. Morgan, BlackRock, Prudential, MetLife, Merrill Lynch, and many, many others, according to the Wall Street Journal.
And probably off the books to a bunch of Russian oligarchs. Just guessing.
Maybe. And that's not counting the many, many very small subcontractors who do work for him and whom he's never paid for the work that they do and who have a claim on him. Now, financial pundits have pointed out that his many golf properties, including Mar-a-Lago, all operate in the red, meaning that none of them make any money at all. Those properties, which he tends to own himself with no other partners, those properties and his hotel and apartment buildings, which he'll own an interest in, maybe not the entire property, all carry large mortgages. Add that to operating loans, construction loans, and lines of credit, and he could be very deeply in debt. He has a tendency to overinflate his self-worth, as everyone knows. He has a tendency to underestimate his actual liabilities, his debts, as everyone knows. So it's very possible he could be in serious financial trouble, and we don't know. In fact, the issue that Congress is most concerned about, or should be most concerned about, is that so many banks and financial institutions own a piece of him that it's really no wonder that Trump's been busy taking apart financial regulations like the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act and trying to dismantle the power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's what Congress really should be using as a justification for asking for his tax returns and getting more information about his personal finances.
And given how many of his creditors are overseas, There's a real concern about whether his debts are influencing his foreign policy.
Yeah, also influencing his foreign policy. But I would be, I would say that what's much more important is the way he's been setting us up for another financial meltdown, just by the way that he and his underlings have taken apart a lot of the financial regulations that were passed post 2007. In order to deal with the crisis.
A lot of them are still on the books. They've just taken away the funding for enforcing them.
Yeah, and taken away the tools that have been used to enforce those. Okay.
So we can expect with the Democrats to be requesting most of the details on this anytime soon?
Oh, yeah. Well, they have. The problem is they're not getting any support. They're not getting any of that information from the Trump administration. This week, more than 800 former federal prosecutors who served in both Democratic and Republican administrations signed a letter saying that the Mueller report provides enough evidence to charge Donald Trump with felony obstruction of justice.
You know, I found it very interesting that William Barr's number two from his first run as attorney general in the early 90s was one of the signatories in that
letter. Yeah, there were a lot of folks who signed that. The signers were all former prosecutors at the Department of Justice, many of them having served decades, some as many as 30 to 40 years or more, under both the Democratic and Republican presidents, all the way back to the Johnson administration. Among the evidence they cited was Trump's attempts to fire Robert Mueller, Trump's instructions for White House counsel Don McGahn to lie about that, and Trump's efforts to prevent witnesses from testifying to the Mueller investigation, including his former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, and campaign manager Paul Manafort, including dangling the possibility of a pardon before them in order to get them to change their testimony. Now, the letter reads, quote, "As former federal prosecutors, we recognize that prosecuting obstruction of justice cases is critical, because unchecked obstruction, which allows intentional interference with criminal investigations to go unpunished, puts our whole system of justice at risk." Now, this statement was echoed later this week by House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler after Donald Trump decided to assert executive privilege over the full Mueller report and the supporting evidence behind it, including transcripts of witness testimony that the House Judiciary Committee had subpoenaed.
Which most of the legal community just kind of laughed.
Yeah. Now, Nadler said, quote, "We have talked for a long time about approaching a constitutional crisis. We are now in a constitutional crisis," end quote. The House has a couple of different actions that it can take. First, it can revive the inherent contempt power and use it to instruct the House sergeant-at-arms to take a witness into custody if they refuse to testify or cooperate, as Attorney General William Barr did this week. Or they might try to use their inherent contempt power to levy fines for noncompliance, although that's never been done before and is controversial.
Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, was suggesting that at a rate of $25,000 a day.
Yeah.
Just to kind of get their attention.
Yeah. Now, the House could also go to court to try to force compliance and ask for a court to impose either imprisonment or fines, but that could take months, if not years. House Democratic representatives are unlikely to go that route unless it's a last resort. Or it could open impeachment proceedings against either Donald Trump or William Barr, or possibly both, and that would strengthen the House's ability to enforce its subpoenas.
Yeah, and then Adam Schiff also has suggested that as a means for adding some legal heft to these subpoenas.
Yeah, now with Gerald Nadler saying that we've entered a constitutional crisis, you really have to ask yourself, why would you not use the one tool that the framers of the Constitution provided to Congress in order to enforce the laws of the United States, and that's the power to impeach the president? Why would they not use that?
Yeah, and the decision to impeach, that goes through Nadler's committee.
Oh, yeah.
Judiciary Committee.
So I would urge people to call Nadler's office and say, it's time. It's time. Pull the trigger. Use the one tool that the framers of the Constitution provided to Congress to hold the power, to hold the president to the Constitution, because this president is not interested in following the Constitution of the United States. He's only interested in his own self-interest and what he wants and wants to get done or not get done.
Or how to enrich himself and his friends.
Yeah.
It's interesting because Niemöller obviously knows Trump very well. He represents Upper Manhattan in the House, and he and Trump have butted heads many times over the past several decades, so I doubt he's under any illusions about the con artist in chief. It really is a question. We saw Nancy Pelosi, of course, the leader of the House Democrats, who's been very resistant to the idea of impeachment, basically making reference to the idea that Trump's out behavior recently has been so outrageous, he's trying to get the House to impeach him, which may very well be true. He seems to be most comfortable painting himself as a victim, which is kind of hilarious for a guy who's worth a lot of money, although how much money exactly is open to question. But he really likes to play up the victimhood thing, which is a common theme on the right. And the idea that he's being further persecuted for doing nothing wrong, in his eyes anyway, is something that he could hang a whole presidential campaign on. And he knows it, and the Democrats know it. And it puts them in a very tricky position politically. But, you know, the question is, this kind of behavior is so extreme. If you don't impeach Trump, it sets a precedent for future presidents. So that's a very, very bad idea long term.
And I think the Democrats underestimate the support among the American population for impeachment. I really think they do.
What happens is when you start televising those hearings, it goes up. This happened during Watergate, which, of course, is a different media environment. You didn't have the social media you have now. But support for impeachment was not very high when those hearings began in 1973. By the time they were done, the idea that Nixon needed to be impeached was conventional wisdom. And I think the same thing would happen here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would think with the social media and the internet, which was not present back then, at least that we know of.
The ability to pass around information.
Yeah, and just be able to, like, watch this when you're walking down the street or on the bus or wherever.
When you get home from work, just, you know, while you're cooking dinner, you're logging in, you're looking at the video and going, holy cow.
Yep.
It'd be like a pay-per-view that you already have paid for.
And afterwards, you can rate it on Yelp.
Yeah, exactly. You can link and pass around the links and all kinds of stuff. You can comment via Twitter. It's just, I think the Democrats, the old school Democrats like Pelosi, they're thinking about the impeachment of Bill Clinton and they're wincing and going, we don't want to get into that whole thing. But there are miles and miles of difference between the two.
Well, and there's, there are these other investigations that are happening simultaneously that we're not hearing about any developments of late. Is there any thinking that there's some holding back to wait for developments there? Or
what do you mean?
Like, well, the New York State investigations with the Trump.
And, yeah, it's possible that New York State could get hold of Donald Trump's tax returns, but they're looking at his state tax returns. State tax returns don't give you as much information in general as federal tax returns do. What they do is they take states take your adjusted gross income from your federal tax return as a given, and then they do their own calculations based on that. That doesn't give you that much information about his personal finances. They'd have to subpoena more. So I don't think that's really what's holding all this up.
Yeah, and we had significant portions of the Mueller report that nobody's seen yet, number one. And certainly the House Intelligence Committee has been saying that since the firing of James Comey, we have gotten no briefings from the administration on intelligence matters, no briefings from the DOJ on the progress of the counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign in 2016. So there's a lot of stuff going on that the administration is just trying to bury. Mm-hmm. And that also is going to wind up in court, I think. And the public's going to see it eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a question of when. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. We should mention that you're listening to KODX FM Seattle 96.9. This is Eat the Airwaves. And if you appreciate what you're hearing, we are an all-volunteer outfit with News and Public Affairs, and we can really use your financial support at www.kodxseattle.org. There's a nice Patreon button that we encourage you to push. Or if you are old school and want to send a check, make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media. That's Earth on the Air Independent Media. And send it to, what's the P.O. Box?
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle 98145.
I don't know why I can't memorize that.
I know.
Half the time I trip up on it here anyway, too. All right.
And thank you to those folks who've already supported the station.
Big thanks. You're the ones that are keeping us keeping us going.
It is the thing that is keeping us going.
That's right, because we can't sell those little shoes we've been making. It just...
What?
Well, we're right. It costs money to feed those kids, even if it's only a couple times a week.
You guys.
All right. Sticking with Donald Trump and the trade war, apparently, happening with China.
Oh, yeah, sure. $200 billion. That's the amount of tariffs that the Trump administration decided this week to they triggered on their trade war, Trump's trade war with China. This is going to be money that will be passed on to American consumers, basically for every kind of good that's made in China and exported to the United States. You know, sneakers and clothing.
Well, clothing is exempt at first, but Trump has said he's going to revisit putting sanctions on that as well. But I think we'll see it mostly in electronic devices like new phones.
Yeah.
Portable devices like laptops, devices like computers, businesses and regular consumers, just ordinary people, are going to feel these. Whereas his past sanctions, it was mostly manufacturers and businesses and farmers that felt the sanctions, particularly when China put their own sanctions on us
and
on our farm
goods.
They're
expected shortly to announce more retaliatory trade measures, mostly aimed at the agricultural sector in red states. Mm-hmm. Trump administration has been trying to ameliorate the effect of the previous Chinese tariffs by further bailing out struggling farmers and the struggling ag industry. It's $12 billion spent on that and counting, in a way that's not particularly accountable to the public.
Yeah, and I should point out, too, that America's farmers have been suffering a lot from weather-related disasters last year, but also this spring, floods that have hit the Midwest, all up and down the Midwest.
Oh, yeah.
The southeast region of the United States suffered a lot of flooding last year.
Yeah, and Houston this week.
Yeah, and is set to be hit again this hurricane season, which is just ramping up. You know, the House of Representatives just passed an aid bill that was supposed to help with last year's flooding in the Midwest and southeast of the United States. And it passed through the House with both Democratic and Republican support. But Donald Trump is urging Senate Republicans to not pass it because, of course, why would he help farmers even after he has promised that he would?
Yeah, because there's a really big ocean between him and farmers.
I think it's because he knows they don't have the money for it.
That's never stopped him before.
The budget is so hugely in the red.
That's never stopped him before.
And he can't turn to a bank and say, "Help, I need a loan."
No, he can have Wilbur Ross print money.
And combine that with the impact on farmers when because of Trump's moves against immigrants they lost, you know,
a large pool of labor that would have helped to bring in crops.
So a lot of crops just died on the
rotted
vine.
In the field.
Yeah.
So American farmers are really suffering right now. There are a lot of farmers who have gone out of business just in the last year from all of this.
And a lot of the small towns that depend on agriculture
and others that are barely hanging on
are really losing a lot of the service businesses as well, because there's just no money in the community anymore.
Yeah, and not the people there, the immigrant labor that would need those services too, and would turn a lot of the money that they get paid to do the work that Americans won't do, to turn that money around and spend it in the community. It's just not happening. So,
well, you would expect with all this to have some impact on Trump's approval ratings.
Nope. Trump's approval ratings have been creeping up recently, and this past week was he has his highest approval rating since the month after his inauguration. 45.1% is the average of the aggregate of the various national polls. And, you know, it's really kind of hard to figure out why. I mean, superficially, the economy is doing really well. Unemployment is low because a lot of people have 2, 3, 4 jobs. And, you know, it seems like the more outrageous his behavior is, the more people who wanted an outsider in Washington are cheering for it.
Again, it's important to look at that statistic too for what it is.
Yeah,
it's measuring. It's measuring for. First off, it's 45.1%. That's not a majority of voters.
No, okay? it puts him within.
Secondly, it's voters, right?
Yes,
and
it is.
We're looking at the Republicans having spent more than a decade to try to suppress people who would vote Democrat. So a lot of it, I think, is Republicans saying we want a Republican president. We need a Republican president, even if he's this guy.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think another piece of that. You know, it's become so divisive in terms of the political culture of this country that, you know, in a lot of the country, it's not really safe to say you're not a Republican, or vice versa. In a place like Seattle, it's not safe to say you're a Republican.
But also, too, one of the efforts that the Republicans have done is to try to suppress voting among people who are below a certain economic class. So when you poll voters, you're really talking to people who are safely, very comfortably in the middle class and above for the most part. And those folks like the economy the way it's chugging along, you know, with the stock market up and corporations being able to say, hey, our earnings have been great because we got that big tax cut, et cetera, et cetera. Those folks think things are going along just great.
And the conditions are there for a repeat of 2007, 2008, where all the brakes have been taken off and that bubble is going to burst at some point.
Yeah, and the housing market's been going great guns in a lot of the places where it ran up a bubble before and additional places where that didn't quite have the bubble pop, like here in Seattle. It's and again, banks are able to do things that they hadn't been able to do in the last decade since the 2007 crisis, because the brakes have been taken off and there's no enforcement. So that's also kind of waiting in the wings. Right now we're at the top, but we'll see if that continues.
Well, and by we, I mean.
Kind of the way the government measures the economy, which doesn't take into account the concerns of poor
and
people.
They were also trying to define down the poverty level this past week.
Oh, yes. To try to keep,
which is an old trick. It's been done a number of times over the years.
It's an old trick to make the economy look better and to deny benefits to the largest number of people that the government can get away with. The Trump administration is trying to change the formula that would increase the poverty level by you know, the consumer price index or whatever, to make that increase much smaller year to year. So eventually more and more people would fall out of the category of below poverty level, when right now the poverty level is ridiculously low already.
Especially in a city like Seattle, where basic services cost a lot more than they do in, say, Missouri or North Dakota.
Yeah, but I think even there, the poverty level is a bit of a joke.
Sure it is.
So you're saying it's basically smoke and mirrors. It's
mm-hmm. But a lot of things are based on that federal poverty level, things like housing assistance and things like services that are delivered in local communities and by state
including
governments.
Including Seattle, yeah.
Yeah, rely on the federal poverty level. And if the Trump administration
as well.
can finesse with that to exclude as many people as possible, it's going to have a huge impact around the nation for people who need assistance. And when those folks fall fall out of the ability for local state and local governments to help them, they end up on the street, essentially.
Can we talk about Afghanistan?
Sure.
Do we have time for that?
We do.
Now, the U.S. military has recently stopped issuing critical data about the war in Afghanistan. The war has been going on for 18 years now. And every 3 months since at least 2010, the U.S. military has released a report to the public estimating how much of the country of Afghanistan is controlled by the Taliban versus the U.S.-supported government in Kabul. Last week, the U.S. military command in Afghanistan announced that they would no longer provide that information. Recent reports had shown that the Taliban are gaining ground while the government in Kabul is losing ground. January's assessment showed that the Kabul government controlled territory inhabited by 63.5% of the population. And keep in mind, they control mostly the cities. That's just over two-thirds of the population of the country, a 1.7% decrease from the previous quarter, which means, of course, because they control most of the cities, that they're losing a lot of the rural areas of Afghanistan. Taliban attacks have increased by 19%, even as the Taliban continue to meet with a U.S. negotiating team in Qatar, and they just wrapped up their sixth round of peace negotiations there, just between the U.S. government and the Taliban.
The Kabul government is not present for the
because the Taliban will not talk with any representative of the Kabul government. Now, the Taliban have been increasing the pace of attacks and gaining territory, and that would give them more leverage at the negotiating table, which is why even this past week, while they were wrapping up the sixth round of talks, we saw two fresh attacks. Now, the Afghan military and police forces are understaffed, plagued with desertion, and full of what they call ghost soldiers, non-existent personnel whose salaries are pocketed by their corrupt commanders. Remember now that U.S. taxpayer money is funding the Afghan military. In July of last year, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction found that the U.S. government had wasted more than $15 billion of U.S. taxpayer money over the last 11 years in Afghanistan. And that's just money that can't be accounted for.
Yeah. And that after the tranches of money in C-130s that were dropped in Afghanistan. With the original invasion.
Yeah, that's not counting those first 3 years. Now, the Pentagon said in February of last year that it spends a total of $45 billion per year in U.S. taxpayer money to pursue the war in Afghanistan. While it's difficult to separate the total cost of the war in Afghanistan from the war in Iraq, a figure of over $1 trillion is often cited. But really, I think it's closer to $2 trillion the cost of the Afghan war over the last 18 years.
And that cost is not going to include U.S. soldiers who are going to need lifetime care and for the VA, mm-hmm. Health care for things like PTSD or amputated limbs or whatever.
Or the ones who end up on the street and have to be cared for by state and local governments trying to get them rehoused, for example.
Yeah.
As we've seen here in the city of Seattle with a special...
Those kind of taxpayer costs are never included in those kind of estimates.
And the end result, of course, will be a negotiated agreement with the Taliban that allows them back into the government, because that's what they're really pushing for. And it may lead to their eventual full control of the country once again. So we'd be back where we started, essentially. As a point of comparison, you know, when Donald Trump met with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer a couple weeks ago to discuss a big infrastructure plan, the figure he cited was $2 trillion. But Trump, of course, gave no indication then of how he would pay for it. And, of course, that money's not there. It got blown up in Afghanistan.
He also said it around the time that he decided on a tweet to withdraw from Syria that he was going to withdraw from Afghanistan as well. We haven't heard anything further.
We have not heard anything further about the Trump administration withdrawing from Afghanistan. In fact, what we've been hearing is noise from Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, Trump's proxies for foreign policy. We've been hearing about let's ramp up actions against Iran as if they would like to invade Iran next.
That's something John Bolton has wanted to do for 20 years.
For a long time. Yeah. that directly goes against Donald Trump's stated foreign policy goals to withdraw U.S. troops from foreign wars.
Well, I did see yesterday that the Pentagon okayed a transfer of $1.5 billion that was slated for Afghanistan to go to the
Well, no, it wasn't all slated for Afghanistan. About $600 million was is all that they mentioned from Afghanistan. And they said that that was money they'd saved on contracts that Congress had appropriated for it, but they hadn't spent yet because the contracts that they'd engaged with defense contractors had not required them to spend that money. So that makes you wonder what other money's just kind of sitting around loose in loose change at the Pentagon.
I would imagine there's quite a few slush funds.
Apparently $900 million because they took that from other accounts at Pentagon, although they didn't say what those accounts were, that at least that much is available. So I think it's past time that Congress and U.S. taxpayers got a better look at spending at the Pentagon and where it all goes.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else on that? Otherwise, got some events coming up.
Yeah. Dave Lippman is in town. He's in town tonight, in fact. So go check him out. Long time satirical folk singer, political. He's at Cafe Paloma, 93 Yesler Way. Reservations are strongly recommended because he's a popular guy and it's a small venue. Again, Cafe Paloma in Pioneer Square, 93 Yesler Way. Look up and call the number. Let them know you're coming.
Yeah, and tonight in Red Square, starting at 5:30 p.m., is the UW Night Market, co-hosted with the Taiwanese Student Association at UW. The market will offer Taiwanese and Pan-Asian foods, live music, and games. It will be open until 10:30 p.m. tonight. Also on Sunday is Extinction Rebellion's planning meeting from 1 to 2:30 at the Green Lake branch of the Seattle Public Library. That's at 7364 East Green Lake Drive North. On Wednesday is a free training and panel on Public Records 101. Learn how to do a public records request and gain information from any public institution.
It's easy and it's fun.
It's easy
and
it's fun. I
highly recommend learning that skill.
Yeah, yes. That's on Wednesday from 7:30 to 10 p.m.
Over the years, we've uncovered a whole lot of dirt that way.
Oh, yeah. That's Wednesday from 7:30 to 10 p.m. at the Summit on Pike, 420 East Pike Street on Capitol Hill. On Thursday, the Transit Writers Union General Membership Meeting, held every third Thursday of the month at 6:30 p.m. in the Seattle Labor Temple. That's at 2800 First Avenue in Hall 8. I suggest checking that out. Friday is From Past to Present, a talk with Dr. Angela Davis, hosted by UW-Bothell Black Student Union. Her talk will be followed by a Q&A and book signing. That's from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at 11122 Northeast 180th Street in Bothell. On Friday again is Neoliberal Seattle, The City as Investment. It will examine how Seattle lost its affordable housing and became a playground for rich techies. That's from 7:30 to 9:15 p.m. at the Summit on Pike, 420 East Pike Street on Capitol Hill. That's part of Red May, which is a month of events exploring alternatives to capitalism. You can find more events, which they seem to have scheduled almost every day.
Yeah, they've got a lot of good stuff
listed
going on.
At redmayseattle.org on the web. And then finally, Friday is a panel discussion, Defining Cascadia, Crossing Borders to Improve Ecology, Economy, and the Arts in the Pacific Northwest. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Horizon Books at 1423 10th Avenue on Capitol Hill.
And also, and then just next Saturday is the Saturday and Sunday is the University Street Fest.
Street Fair. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's coming up.
We'll get to navigate that next week.
You yeah. will. We'll see how well you navigate that.
Well, next week. Get ready for that.
All right.